Find her expert advice anytime at thinkblink.com and find her live midday every Sunday on 95.5 FM and AM 750 News Talk WSB.
Welcome back, everybody, to the weekly show, live on Sundays, 11 to 1. Well, actually, 12 to 2, because it's football here on News Talk WSB. The number today, 404-872-0750, where we are rebuilding America one house at a time, starting, of course, with yours. If you're not following me online, you're missing half the conversation. You can follow me on Twitter. My Twitter handle is at Glink, at G-L-I-N-K. You can also sign up for my free weekly newsletter at thinkglink.com. And if you are interested in learning all there is to know, or at least all that I know, about investing in real estate, check out my Intentional Investor, How to Be Wildly Successful in Real Estate ebook and webinar series. Just go to thinklink.com and click on the red house. So this is the big week of healthcare, October 1st, the date when everybody is supposed to be able to go online and enroll. And meanwhile, we were on the edge of our seats all week, figuring out what was going to go on with the government. Bruce Jepson joins me on the line now to talk about Obamacare and what's going on with it. Bruce is the former healthcare reporter at the Chicago Tribune, Modern Healthcare Magazine, and now he writes for Forbes, the New York Times, and Chicago Medicine Magazine. He has been around the media for a very long period of time. You can follow him on Twitter, Bruce Jepson, J-A-P-S-E-N, or you can go to blogs.forbes.com/Bruce Jepson and follow his blog there. Bruce, welcome back to the program.
Elise, thanks for having me.
So this is really interesting because across the country we've just seen, I know that health care for all is sort of a politicized topic anyway, and certainly in Atlanta here, Obamacare is met with certainly a note of question anyway. What is going on nationally, though? It seems to me, though, this is now moving ahead and people are signing up. And what are they finding?
Well, Elise, they're finding out what those of us who have had private coverage have already know. The president was correct when he said that the premiums will be low. I mean, some folks can get subsidies and get a plan for maybe $100 a month. On average, it's between $300 and $400 a month. So the good news is they get access to a private health plan and private coverage. The bad news is they get an access to private health plans and private coverage. It's complicated, and it will remain so because you still, even in this open enrollment phase, you still have to make choices. You still have to really read the plan. You have to see what's covered, see what's best for you and your family. And the good news of all this is that the open enrollment period, it's not like at your employers where you get a week or two to decide. You have until the end of next March, if you're uninsured or if you are low income and you're looking into these exchanges, you have a long time to decide and to look into it, and you should take your time.
So what's interesting to me, as I've been starting to look into it, because my husband Sam and I, as everybody who listens to the show knows, we've been buying our own health care for years. I mean, for 25 years that we've been together. And it's really expensive. I mean, for a family of four, we pay more than $3,000 a month for premiums. And
crazy.
And it's not like it covers things like dental, right? It's not even like we have a special gold-plated plan. It's just an expensive plan. But we're like so many other people in our 40s and early 50s. We have what the industry considers to be pre-existing conditions, though I would tell you I'm really healthy.
Mm-hmm.
And I really don't have anything seriously wrong with me. The other thing that's sort of interesting about these plans that I've been thinking about is how you have to look at what doctors are covered, what hospitals are covered.
Definitely.
And that this is changing. You know, I'm used to a plan which covers everything and everybody, basically.
Yeah, and that is definitely something people should check into, because sometimes you can get a good deal. Whether you're going to go to the Obamacare exchange, you've never had coverage before, and you're going to go to coverage, or if you're going to look at private health insurance, or even if you have it in your employer, you got to check every year, talk to your doctor. They have contract negotiations with insurance companies. Make sure that your doctor is in your network, because sometimes health insurance companies, to make more affordable products, will narrow the network. And that's not necessarily a bad thing either. Sometimes health plans are not negotiating with doctors in their networks because the doctors will not adhere to certain quality standards. Now, the good news for the Kling family is that, I know Sam and your kids and everything, the good news for you guys is that there are now regulations in place where the Obamacare Affordable Care Act has to provide 10 essential health benefits. So there, when people go to these exchanges, they also have access to vision coverage and mental health coverage. You know, you might have your therapist might be covered. There's more basic benefits for everybody. And that's even if you have a state-regulated plan. And in Illinois, for example, the state several years ago required mandatory coverage for maternity care and certain fertility benefits and so forth. All plans now have to have that. Now, that is good news for some, but it's not for others. So if you're like 55-year-old widower, your kids are grown, you're on your own.
You're not having a baby.
You're not having a baby.
Exactly. At least not with the current medical situation.
You're just fine in the fertility department.
Right.
That's where some of the costs are going up, because these essential health benefits, some people might say, listen, I'm Superman, and you know what? I don't need mental health because I have a martini every Friday night. Some of those folks
Friday?
Costs are
they
going
wait
up.
Till Friday? No, I'm
kidding.
So it's interesting. Okay, so you brought up a couple of things that I think are worth digging into. One is the idea that there are these basic things that are covered for everybody, even if you don't specifically need it. So we had maternity coverage for all the years that I, you know, might get pregnant. Now I'm, you know, past that time. And yet, now with these new plans, that's just part of it. It's not like you negotiate different benefits that you want or that you don't want. It's just, and there is no additional fee for maternity coverage. It's just part and parcel of the whole thing.
Exactly.
Okay, well, that makes it easier in some ways, and it could make it more expensive. The other thing I'm hearing from some of the columnists who have been working on this is that they are hearing that in some places, like in California and New York, the cost coverage is actually coming in lower than had been predicted. And yet, for some people who are buying it individually, like I am, costs are going up. What are you seeing or what are you hearing about that?
Well, it's going to go up. For some, it's going to go down. So let's just say you are a single person right out of college. You were unlike a lot of young people, and you got coverage. Your costs might now, for young people, go up because the package of benefits that you got, a bare bones package, you think you're invincible, you don't need all these extras, you can't get a lot of things carved out anymore, you now have to buy a more richer package and so forth. So but yet for families such as yours, your coverage should go down or should stabilize. It all depends, because this is all actuaries here. They're expanding the pool, and so it's sort of fairer to everybody. I know there's people out there listening, and I'm like, well, you know, that's fair, schmear, you know, just buy
it. It's all about what goes on in my pocket.
Exactly.
I know. It's true. But it affects all of us, and it affects, you know, none of us, right? So every time somebody who's uninsured goes to a hospital, you know, that falls right on the back of taxpayers, just all of us, right? We all pay for stuff like that, and that's what this is supposed to avoid. Let me ask you just a quick question before we go to the break. When you're looking at these different plans, and I have to say, I think healthcare.gov is doing a pretty good job, better than I thought it would, for just steering you to the right place and giving you some basic understanding. But are you finding that people don't understand the choices that are in front of them? Do you think that people are now, because there's just so much information focused on this moment, this date when everything opens up, do you think people are starting to really come alive and wake up to this idea?
I hope so. I think they will, just because there's been so much attention put on it. But let me tell you this. I wrote a column that essentially said people don't understand health insurance, let alone Obamacare. There was a study out, and I'm sorry I don't remember the source of the study, but that something along the lines of 11% of Americans with insurance don't even understand the basic structure of coinsurance, deductibles, copays, etc. That's a huge problem. So the fact that more people are going to be getting health insurance hopefully will become more savvier customers, and that will bring some more transparency to it and make us better shoppers for healthcare like we have been when we go buy a car or a house.
Where can people go to get really good information? I thought healthcare.gov was a good place to start. What are you liking as well?
Well, that's a good question, and I'm glad you brought that up. So healthcare.gov is a good one. Now, if you want to go to a thing I just stumbled on over the weekend, the Kaiser Family Foundation.
Oh, that's a good one.
Which is a good one. They actually have I linked to this in my most recent blog post. You can find it. It's called a subsidy calculator. You can punch in your state, your income, your children, et cetera, whether you're employed or not, and figure out if you're eligible for a subsidy. There might be folks that, you know, are like, well, you know what? I got coverage. I'm happy with it, whatever. You might make a certain amount of money. You know what? You might be eligible for a subsidy or a tax break. So you can go to that website and check that out before you talk to someone with the government or a health insurance plan, for starters. And, you know, and also, you know, your accountant should know a little bit about this. I mean, there are some certain benefits. I mean, there are people that say, well, why you can get a subsidy if you make up to $90,000 a year and have a family. Some people say, well, that's a lot of money. Not necessarily. If you're paying $20,000 a year out of pocket, you know, healthcare has been eating 25% to maybe 30% of your budget before taxes.
Right, so, and there is a lot of things going on now, and we can talk about this when we come back, this move for big companies to shed coverage and give people money to just go out and buy what is a better plan for them as opposed to taking it online. And people don't even realize what share of their health care costs companies are already paying, and I think that there's a really interesting calculation that's going on like that. We're talking with Bruce Jabson, in addition to being a friend of mine and a colleague. Bruce is a blogger for Forbes. He's the former healthcare business reporter at the Chicago Tribune and Crane's Modern Healthcare. And you can find him on Twitter at Bruce Jabson, at Bruce Jabson, J-A-P-S-E-N, or at blogs.forbes.com/Bruce Jabson. I'm Elise Glink. We are rebuilding America one house at a time, starting with your healthcare plan today, apparently. Stay tuned. We'll be back with more on this conversation in just a moment on News Talk WSB.
Find her expert advice anytime at thinkglink.com and find Elise Glink live midday every Sunday on 95.5 FM and AM 750 News Talk WSB.
Hey, welcome back, everybody, to the Elise Glink Show, Rebuilding America one house at a time, starting with yours here on News Talk WSB. Online, thinkglink.com, and don't forget to check out Twitter at Glink, at G-L-I-N-K. I'm on the phone with Bruce Jabson. Bruce is a healthcare reporter. He's a former healthcare business reporter at the Chicago Tribune and Crane's Modern Healthcare Magazine. Now he's writing for Forbes, New York Times, Chicago Medicine Magazine, and you can find him on Twitter at Bruce Jabson. Bruce, we've talked about sort of the individual exchanges for Obamacare. Let's talk about the corporate side, because there have been a number of big company announcements in recent weeks that they're going to stop either directly supplying health care to their employees or their retirees, moving people over to private exchanges, though, not public exchanges. So why don't we explain the difference between those and how it's going to affect people?
Yeah, definitely, Elise. The public exchanges, that is basically a website, if you will, the whole Affordable Care Act, Obamacare, if you will, situation where you can go there and you can buy subsidized coverage based on income and so forth. Now, private exchanges, said simply, are something your employer is going to set up. It will probably, in Walgreens' case, has it as a Walgreens name. But what it is that the rather than do the traditional health insurance where you get all your paperwork and so forth and the company pays a portion of it, the company is going to decide they're going to give you a credit or a certain amount of money, and you are going to be able to go online, sort of like an Amazon.com approach to healthcare, and you're going to be able to choose your own benefits and coverage options. You will probably, in most cases, have just as good a coverage. Sort of the wild card down the road is, will they raise the amount that is covered like they have the 9-10% cost increases they have over time? Probably not, but you're going to get an experience where you're going to be more engaged with your healthcare system, because quite frankly, employers are saying, listen, we have to do something else. We have to more engage our employees with what's going on and how much things cost.
Right. So do you think that more companies are going to say, hey, we're going to do these private exchanges and we're just watching how this is going on, and next year in 2014 and 2015, we're just going to see this roll over? And I just have, keep your answer short because we're running out of time.
Oh, definitely. This is a sea change here. This is going on. Walgreens made a big announcement. Darden Restaurants, Sears, A.N. Hewitt, which is helping companies set it up, said there are 17 employers that they were not ready to disclose because people haven't gotten their open enrollment forms yet. So
we're going to see more.
Definitely check it out.
Yeah, we're going to see more of this for sure. Bruce, thank you so much for joining me today.
Thanks for having me.
Bruce Jabson is a blogger for Forbes. You can follow him at blogs.forbes.com/Bruce Jabson. When we come back, we're going to continue the conversation where we are rebuilding America one house at a time, starting with yours on News Talk WSB. Welcome back, everybody, to the Elise Kling Show, live on Sundays 11 to 1 here on News Talk WSB. We are rebuilding America one house at a time, starting with yours. Don't forget to check out thinkglink.com, thinkglink.com. And if you're interested in investing in real estate, be sure to click on the red house and check out my Intentional Investor Series. 9 ebooks, 9 webinars, one great series, although you can buy it in piecemeal as well if you like. I've got Dick LaPree with me on the phone. Dick has been doing mortgages online since 1995. He works for the San Francisco Office of Residential Pacific Mortgage. It's a mortgage bank. And since 1995, he's produced a weekly newsletter called Rate Watch, which is received by over 25,000 people each week. He and I have done all kinds of stuff together. Way back in 1995, we worked on a site called homeowners.com, which was an early standard for online mortgage lending. It was such a fun thing to do. Dick, welcome back to the program.
Good to talk again, Elise.
Hey, Dick, so the thing that I remember most about you is that you were the first person to explain to me what a pay option mortgage was. And that turned out to become the tipping point for basically the entire housing crisis. And I remember talking to you back in the early aughts, as they say, like around 2003, and you said, you'll never believe this, but people are, they're earning $50,000 a year and they're qualifying for $500,000 mortgages. And I thought that was so insane.
Well, in retrospect, it was insane.
Right, and look what happened because of it.
I think that, and I wrote about it at the time, I think that there are situations where those option arms were justified, but it really was a small percentage of the people who got them. And by that, I mean, if they were justified, let's say, for people who had incomes that were about to rise dramatically, maybe young professionals who knew their income was going to be twice as much 5 years from now as it was today, perhaps people who were buying a new home without selling their prior home. So I think there are cases where it made sense. But for the most part, they were deployed incorrectly. People were just sold on them as, hey, buy this house and you just have to make this very small payment without recognizing that loan balances were going to go up and they were going to be left, you know, with no situation that was good in the future.
You know, I used to write about negative equity in my columns, and my editor at the Chicago Tribune would say, you always have to add a parenthetical and explain what that is. And I would have to say that now, all these years later, everybody knows what negative equity is. We don't have to actually write that anymore. So today I wanted you to kind of pull out, if not a crystal ball, talk a little bit about how some of the things that are coming down the pike in the future, like the QRMs, the qualified residential mortgages, the new rules about how people are going to qualify and who is going to qualify and for how much money they're going to qualify. Starting, I think it's January 10th of 2014, there's a bunch of new rules going into effect.
Right. All of these rules are a consequence of Dodd-Frank, which created Consumer Financial Protection Board, which has taken a little over a year or so to set the rules in place as to what mortgages have to look like starting, as you said, January 10th, 2014. Now, understand there's two sides to this. What they're trying to do is define for mortgage lenders what a qualified residential mortgage is. So that's something that's that gives a lender protection. In other words, if I as a lender make a qualified mortgage, then I know that I'm not going to get in trouble and I'm not going to get sued by the borrower later for doing, you know, let's just describe it as a funky loan. Okay, so it's an attempt to give lenders safety or safe harbor. Now, the downside of it is that what it's done is it's made it tougher to qualify. And by tougher, I just mean tougher than it presently is. And understand that we're talking here basically about Freddie Mac and Fannie Mae loans. It's saying, whereas right now, Fannie Mae will allow a debt ratio of up to 45%, the QRM rule says you can't go above 43%. Freddie Mac allows a debt ratio of up to 50%. QRM says it's got to stop at 43%. So there's going to be some people who won't be able to qualify after January 10th for as much mortgage as they could today. So I think that's going to both put a slight damper on prices and perhaps hold a few people out of the housing market that would otherwise be able to qualify.
So let's just clarify for everybody playing along at home. When you say 45%, you mean if your gross monthly income is, let's say, $5,000 a month, it's 45% of the gross, not the take-home pay. So Freddie is doing 50% of the gross. That could be like 60, 62% of your take-home pay, right?
Yes. In other words, it's always based on gross income. When we say gross income, again, we're talking about W-2 people.
Right. It's a lot harder even for people who are self-employed. But so this kind of, let's just start at the very beginning. Should people who would be spending 62 or 63% of their take-home pay, should they even be buying a home? Shouldn't they just go buy a less expensive home? Do people need to be that strung out? Is that good policy?
But I think ultimately, at least, I think that's up for people to decide. I think that as long as people are well-informed and they understand what they're spending, that basically it's their choice to make. That, you know, everybody should be allowed to spend as much as, I mean, in my view, everybody should be allowed to spend as much as they want on housing as long as one way or another they can afford it. I mean, for some people, as you're saying, if they're pushing the edge of their ratio, it simply means that they're going to buy a certain house and there's going to be other things that they're going to have to forego the purchase of. But that, to me, is up for the individual to decide.
And yet the government is stepping in and rolling that back and saying, no, you're not going to be able to go over 43% of your gross monthly income, which is seriously like half of your paycheck or even a little bit more than half of your take-home pay anyway. So if you're bringing home $2,000 a month, you could be spending about $1,000 of that on housing, taxes, and insurance, right?
Yes. Well, no, you could be spending 43% of that on housing. So if you're bringing home $2,000, you'd be going up to $860.
But I thought 43% is gross, not take-home pay.
Oh, I'm sorry. I misunderstood you. Right. It's 43% of your gross.
Okay. So people are really, I think the disconnect comes in for most Americans who we just heard for our prior guest, Bruce Jepson, that they don't even understand what a deductible is, a lot of them on their own insurance, you know, policies. So telling people about the difference between gross and take-home pay, is that a disconnect that could be solved by simply saying, here's your take-home pay, and this is how much you're going to be spending out of it. Is that doable for you?
Well, I mean, as a loan officer who talks to people every day about this, I never discuss with people take-home pay. We just base everything on gross because that's what we've always done. So people, I think, are geared to understanding that mortgage qualifying is tied to gross.
Right, but wouldn't it be more clear to say, you have their W-2, so you know what their take-home pay is. You get paid copies of pay stubs, right?
Wait, I don't in any way disagree with the notion that what you're suggesting makes sense. And I'm not trying to be glib here. I'm saying it does make sense. It's simply never the way the mortgage business has looked upon this. They've always looked on income as gross, and that's it.
Right.
But I mean, you would have to make, you know, you'd have to, otherwise you'd be making adjustments for example, states where you had state income tax and states where there was no state income tax. So are you saying to me, does it make more sense to do this based on your net income? Yeah, I think so.
I'm just saying, I think No, I know it's not the way the mortgage industry works. What I'm saying is I think one of the big problems that the mortgage industry has had and still has, not maybe you because I think you're among the best that I've seen, but one of the great problems is communicating with a new generation of borrowers, or maybe even the old generation of borrowers, for whom the understanding of what this is going to cost them somehow isn't there. And I know that there have been the CFPB, Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, has been involved. They're trying to get more clear on this. Everybody keeps trying to clarify the language, but yet I find for me as a real estate expert and writer, journalist, whatever you want to call me, I find that the new jargon is just replacing the old jargon, and people are just as confused as they ever were, and I don't understand how we're going to kind of maneuver around that, but yet, to your point, fewer people are going to be able to afford to buy a home come January.
Yes, and one more thing about the changes. The changes do make the disclosures a bit more understandable and comprehensible. Actually, they make them substantially more understandable and comprehensive than the present disclosure. So I think that is one good thing about CFPB and Dodd-Frank is it's producing disclosures that people can actually understand.
That is good. So do you think that lenders, if fewer people are going to be able to afford to buy a home, are we going to see kind of a reversal of the housing market that we've had so far?
I think only to a slight extent. In other words, I would put it this way. I think that the price gains that we've seen in the last year, which have been fairly healthy, I think that those are going to slow down as we adjust to this. And it's going to take 3 months, 6 months, maybe even longer to adjust to the new rules. And then we'll see where prices are. Unless somebody who's a big fan of massive appreciation values in housing because it makes homes unaffordable for people. So I think that sane increases in value are what's called for.
And then also, it strikes me that we may also by then have a little bit more of a rise in interest rates. I know the Fed has decided to keep those printing presses going, and they're continuing to buy mortgage-backed securities, but I think we're also eventually going to see mortgage interest rates rise up again, don't you?
Well, and as you know from reading my newsletters, I talk about this constantly. And in the short term, meaning the next couple of months, I think that rates are going to go down a little bit more. They've already gone down substantially in just the last 2 weeks. So I think that we're looking at a slight dip in rates and then a move back upwards in rates. And then, I think that in the spring of next year, in the spring of 2014, we should actually see interest rates start down again. So I always talk about cycles. I think the big cycle that everybody needs to be aware of is that over the next several tens of years, interest rates are going to rise, and they're going to be dramatically higher 20 years from now than they are today. But in the meantime, we see these changes where interest rates more or less move up for a year and a half and then down for a year and a half. So the short answer is we're going to see lower rates until the end of this year, and then we'll probably see higher rates for a couple of months. And I think in the spring of 2014, we'll see rates move back down again a little bit. We're not going to get back to those record lows that we saw a year ago, but we'll get back beneath where we are right now.
Well, at least let's hope not, because if we are, it means there's something really wrong with the economy again. We're talking with Dick LaPree. He's a mortgage lender and has been doing that since 1995 out of San Francisco. You can learn more about Dick at rpm.mtg.com, mortgage.com, or find him on Twitter. That's the best place. I'll also put this up on my website, at Dick LaPree, L-E-P-R-E. Dick, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you, Elise. Have a good day.
Thanks. Really appreciate it. All right. Stay tuned. We'll be back in a moment with more of the Elise Glink Show. Rebuilding America, one house at a time, starting with yours on News Talk WSB. Welcome back, everybody, to the Elise Glink Show. Rebuilding America, one house at a time, starting with yours on News Talk WSB. Don't forget to follow me on Twitter. I'm at Glink, at G-L-I-N-K. Coming up next, we've got Farnoosh Torabi. She is a personal finance expert, author, and TV personality. She is so fun And her author, she is the author of a book called You're So Money, Live Rich Even When You're Not. And she also hosts this really cool thing on Yahoo Finance called Fiscally Fit. It's a, Financially Fit. It's a Webby-nominated show, and it talks about sort of the everyday things that you can do to boost your earnings and savings and all that kind of stuff. She's just great. So she's coming up next. I wanted to answer an email that I got this week online or on the air right now. Somebody asked me a question about how should they know if a refinancing is right for them? And so we talked about it on the show last week. We had this woman call in, and she just was going to save like $144,000 plus whatever she was going to save monthly. That was just shortening her loan term from 20 years to 10 years. The power of this, I cannot overstate it. It is just incredible. So let me just quickly run down my four rules for a home run refinance. Right? Number one, you lower your monthly payment. Everybody wants to pay less, and that's great. Number two, you lower the interest rate, and that's usually what happens, and that's how you get the lower payment. Number three, third rule, and it's really important, you shorten the loan term. Every time you can cut off 5 years, that's 5 years worth of payments that you're saving. It is fantastic. And then, finally, you got to watch your closing costs. So you pay less, you lower the interest rate, you cut your loan term, and you watch your closing costs. All of that together, if you hit all four of those, it is a no-brainer home run refinance, and you should do it as quickly as you can. And it may still be a great refinance if you could do three out of those or two out of those. But for a complete home run, you want all four. All right, stay tuned to the Elise Kling Show, Rebuilding America One House at a Time, starting with yours. We're going to have Farnoosh Torabi on next. Follow me on Twitter at Glink, at GLINK, so you don't miss the other half of the conversation. I'm Elise Kling. We'll be back with more in a moment on News Talk WSB.
It's live, expert money and real estate advice every Sunday. Elise Kling is on 95.5 FM and AM 750, News Talk WSB.
Hey, welcome back, everybody, to the Elise Kling Show, live on Sundays, 12 to 2 on News Talk WSB. 404-872-0750, 1-800-WSB-TALK. Online all the time, the website thinkglink.com. Follow me on Twitter. I'm at Glink, at G-L-I-N-K. So Farnoosh Torabi joins me now. She's a personal finance expert, author, and TV personality. I love that the New York Times calls her advice perfectly practical. She's the author of You're So Money, Live Rich Even When You're Not. And she also hosts the Webby-nominated show Financially Fit on Yahoo, which helps everyday kinds of finances, people who want to boost their earnings, save more, and spend smart. And she's recently joined Katie Couric's new talk show. Katie is the program's personal finance expert. That is so cool. Farnoosh, welcome to the program.
I'm so excited. Thanks for having me, Elise.
So everybody wants to know how to make more money, how to bring, you know, big bucks in. Even small bucks can be helpful. What are you seeing online with your show? What are people really clicking on?
They love to learn about ways to make easy money safely on the internet, preferably. There's a lot of offerings, as we know, online, make money quickly overnight, and those are largely too good to be true. But there are a lot of wonderful websites that have bubbled up over the last couple of years. I think out of necessity, people need to make more money. They're not able to find necessarily that one job that's going to pay all the bills, or able to convince their bosses to give them raises. So they're finding ways to, in the evenings, over the weekends, in their spare time, bring in extra revenue without any overhead. As long as you have an internet connection and some free time and, a willingness to work, or in some cases not even, you can make some cash that can go a long way, whether it's to help pay the bills or have it be the beginnings of something much, much bigger. Some of the popular websites we're finding that are, again, safe and legit and have really good results, Elance.com is one site where if you're somebody who is really good at writing, technology, copywriting, software development, graphic design, Elance.com is a site where you can go and basically bid, have people bid for your services. So you go on there and you create a profile, you upload your resume, and then you start to look at some of the jobs that companies are offering, but also individual business owners are offering. Maybe they need somebody to help them with some copywriting, and then you can bid for your business. Also, there's tutor.com. For those of us who have a skill, maybe it's
math. I could think that math would be very helpful here.
Yes.
If you're a math expert.
Tutors get the most money, according to this site. It pays anywhere from $12 to $14 an hour. You have to get accredited through their site, but once you are, you're ready to go. I mean, they provide you with all of the resources, the software, to then be able to virtually teach with your students. And the students can be any age from, you know, young to senior citizens who want to maybe brush up on a skill or learn a language. And finally, there's a cool site called TaskRabbit, which has been around for a few years now, and it's gaining some momentum with people, especially stay-at-home moms who want to enjoy running their own tasks, whether it's, you know, going grocery shopping, picking up, doing errands, and then maybe finding other people in their neighborhood who need errands run, and they can fold those errands into their own day and make some money along the way. I interviewed a mom who helps her neighbors pick up their dry cleaning or drop off laundry, and she makes, you know, $50 to $70 each time she does that per day.
Really? That's actually a lot of money.
It is. And I mentioned earlier about making money without lifting a finger. Like, how do I make money without actually physically moving? And there's this new economy that supports making money off of things that you have and aren't using to their maximum capacity, like your car. Our cars sit idle most of the day. Even if we're driving to work, it's sitting in the work parking lot. And many families have more than one car. So for the car that's sitting idle most of the day, you can actually rent that out to travelers or even to people in your community who want to borrow the car for an hour or two to go to IKEA or whatever. Rent it out by the hour. There's a company called RelayRides.com, offers insurance to car owners backed by Warren Buffett's insurance company, up to $1 million in liability.
Mm-hmm.
That these people who give their cars to strangers can do it with more confidence and, you know, the full faith that if anything happens, they'll be protected. And people earn an average of $250 a month with this site. Some many earn much more, able to pay off their entire car payments every month.
That's half
money.
Yeah, that's actually really amazing. I mean, the people could take what they have. If you think about the share economy, the whole Airbnb thing.
Exactly.
Where
that's part of it. That's Airbnb really led the march to encourage other, you know, entrepreneurs to think of other ways we can, like you say, you know, make the most of the things that you have that you aren't using, whether it's a spare bedroom. I'm actually using Airbnb this winter when I go to Paris with my family. Rather than renting a hotel room, we're going to stay in a flat that is through Airbnb. That's going to be a lot cheaper and probably more fun.
Yeah, I like the idea of doing that. I also like the idea, I mean, honestly, French pastries and coffee could not be better for breakfast, but it's actually sometimes nice to, everybody's not up and out at the same time. You can walk to the corner bakery, pick up some pastry, come back, and just sort of have a little bit of a slower start in the morning. And that's
absolutely.
Kind of,
I mean, you really feel like a Parisian. You feel more immersed into that neighborhood that you're staying in. Of course, hotels are nice and they're luxurious, but more and more people are, you know, finding that living in apartments or even couch surfing, it's more fun, it's more adventurous, if that's what you're going for.
How do you feel? I know that some people are worried, like, well, with a hotel, you know what you're getting, but when you're moving, getting into somebody's apartment, it may not be great. Now, I have done that where we went to the wine country out in California with some friends, and they've done this before, and they have rented sort of dud houses, but we happened to get a really fabulous house, and it was just so much less expensive than a hotel. It had a pool, and it had views of the vineyards, and it actually had some of our own grapevines, and they're like, yeah, eat the tomatoes, eat the grapes, eat whatever's out there. We don't care. So,
well, you raise a really important point. You have to do your research, and sites like Airbnb know that their business really relies on their trust, Right. You have to be able to create a transparent experience. And when you're going on there to find lodging, now they've actually embedded Facebook into their software. So when you go and search for, say, an apartment in New York City and it's being rented by Joe Schmo, you might realize, hey, Joe Schmo is, you know, 2 degrees of separation from some people you know on Facebook. And that way you might feel more comfortable proceeding with that particular listing because you know that there's some sort of, you know, there's an acquaintance involved, and maybe that will create more trust and a better experience. So they're using Facebook to cultivate more trust and transparency on the site, and I think that's smart.
So let me shift gears a little bit and talk a little bit about healthcare, because we have talked about it, you know, earlier in the show. The exchanges were supposed to be open this week, and, you know, in most cases they were. What are some of the questions that people are asking you that you're trying to answer for people?
People just want to know the basics at this point. You know, how can I shop for health insurance with these exchanges? Sometimes people are curious based on where they are in their lives. Like if I'm 26 years old and I'm getting thrown off my parents' health insurance and I can't get it from my employer because I don't have a full-time job, how can I get health insurance and how might these exchanges benefit me? To even immigrants who contacted us to say, you know, I'm immigrating to the U.S., I have a job lined up, but in the meantime, you know, there's going to be some downtime, maybe 3 months before I can actually qualify for insurance through my employer. Do you think it's advantageous to get individual insurance through the exchanges? So people want to know, A, can I qualify? And the answer is yes, anyone can qualify. But then there's also these subsidies, right, that depending on your income and the size of your family, there's an equation. But basically, you might be able to earn a subsidy to afford and pay for that premium that you're going to get through the exchange.
Right. It's a family of four, I think, can earn something like $94,000 a year and still qualify for some sort of subsidy or tax rebate.
Right. The percentage is going to range from 2% for those with incomes below 133% of poverty, up to 9.5% for individuals and households with incomes up to 400% of the federal poverty level, which, like you said, could be as much as $94,000 a year for a family of four in 2014. So it's not just, you know, the poorest of the poor. This is like, you know, a lot of many Americans right now, and that's a plus, I think, with this. So it's something encouraging, at the least.
I think it's definitely an interesting movement. We'll have to just see. I probably will spend the rest of the weekend going through and trying to figure out if I'm actually going to save any money over and above my own policy. But one of the letters that I got this week, and we've had the same policy for so long that it's grandfathered in, but the minute we go off of it, it'll never be available again with Blue Cross and Blue Shield. And they basically said, look, you can stick with what you have, or you can go with one of these other things and check it out and let us know which way you want to go. And, of course, I believe we have until next March to make that decision and just continue to pay. But I think for many people, they're going to be worried about what kind of safety net is there for them if they're going with these different policies.
Right. And we know there's a penalty for not having insurance. So it's sort of like, it's for some people, they might feel between a rock and a hard place. But I think some health insurance is better than no health insurance. But the affordability is going to be to be determined. But for those of you listening, there's a really cool calculator that I found online that can help you figure out, based again on your income and your family size, how much of a subsidy, and also your state, how much of a subsidy you may qualify for. It's ihealthcareupdates.com. As in the letter I, healthcareupdates.com.
As in Elise. Right. That's good. We also have one from earlier in the show at Kaiser Health Foundation,
yes.
KaiserKFF.org. Farnoosh, can you stick around? We have to take a quick break.
Of course.
All right. We will talk a little bit more with Farnoosh Torabi. She is the host of Financially Fit, which is the Webby-nominated Yahoo series at Yahoo.com. I'm Elise Glink. We're rebuilding America one house at a time, starting with yours on News Talk WSB.
Every Sunday, Elise Glink is live and here to guide you through your money and real estate questions. Only on 95.5 FM and AM 750, News Talk WSB.
Hey, welcome back, everybody, to the Elise Glen Show, Rebuilding America, One House at a Time, starting with yours on News Talk WSB. Farnoosh Torabi is my guest this half hour. She's the host of the Webby-nominated show Financially Fit on Yahoo, and she recently joined Katie Couric's new talk show, Katie, as the program's personal financial expert. And she's been around forever. You can find her online at Farnoosh, FARNOOSH.TV, or follow her on Twitter. She's at Farnoosh. So, Farnoosh, when you look at it, I loved what we were talking about earlier about places where people can find real money that they can make. Do you think that this new economy where everybody has a PayPal account, people have Square, which attaches to their phones and they can take their own credit cards, do you think we've reached kind of a tipping point, a new place where, you know, this just makes it so easy for everybody to be their own business?
Yes, I think that technology has shattered many, many barriers to entry. And the main one is, you know, having the resources. And now the resources are at your fingertips. A lot of times they're free or very, very affordable, whether it's an app or your phone that's going to help you accept payments or Square, like you said. I think that it's an exciting time, I think, for business owners. For consumers, I'm a little concerned. I think that because it's so easy now to spend money, because we can basically spend with our phones and everything is electronic, that barrier to entry doesn't exist, and therefore I think for some people who may have a hard time budgeting, a hard time really curbing their enthusiasm when it comes to shopping, that's going to be a pitfall for them. I think that we already know that when people use cold, hard cash, they spend less because there is that psychological recourse. You have to think about what you're spending. You have to think about the fact that that money is not going to be there after you make that purchase. You have to think about kind of the trade-off. But with electronic spending and this really fast-paced electronic world we live in with money and financial transactions, I think that there it's fertile ground for making mistakes. It's also fertile ground for perhaps getting further into debt.
Right,
I hate to be so negative, but I do think that
you're such a negative Nelly.
To overspend.
Well, I think those are great warnings and great tips. And you've got a new book coming out next May, so we'll have you back again. What's the new book about?
Thanks. Yes, it's called When She Makes More, 10 Rules for Breadwinning Women. And, of course, this is not a new topic. We've been talking about it for many months now, all year, in fact. About 40% of women in households are the primary breadwinners. And I think that I'm a part of that trend. I think it's a wonderful paradigm shift, economic shift, but at the same time, what we're finding is that there are a lot of complexities that come along with having the woman in the relationship be the one who brings home the bigger paycheck, who brings home the filet mignon, as we say.
Well, I can't wait till the book comes out, and we'll certainly have you back to talk about it, and thanks for being with us today.
Thanks so much, Elise. Have a great weekend.
I will. You do the same. Farnoosh Torabi, you can find her online, farnoosh.tv, or on Twitter, at Farnoosh, FARNOOSH. In Yahoo Finance, she's got the web show Financially Fit. When we come back, we're going to continue our conversation about small business and what you can do to make some more money with Grant Cardone. He is the star of the reality TV show Turnaround King, and he hosts his own radio show called The Cardone Zone. I'm Elise Glink. You're listening to News Talk WSB. Hey, welcome back, everybody, to the Elise Glink Show, Rebuilding America One House at a Time, starting with yours on News Talk WSB. So it is my great pleasure to bring back a friend of mine, Grant Cardone, the New York Times best-selling author. He is the executive producer and star of the reality TV show Turnaround King, and he hosts a radio show called The Cardone Zone. And Grant's got three companies. One is called Cardone Training Technologies, where he creates and implements processes that improve sales for automotive organizations and others. Cardone Enterprises, which is all about video and audio products. And Cardone Real Estate Holdings, where he buys hundreds of millions of dollars worth of property. So he's got three businesses going, and I thought maybe he could come online and give us some information on how to make all of our businesses run better. Grant, welcome back to the program.
Hey, Hi, thanks for having me, Elise. I love your program.
Well, thanks. So tell me a little bit about what you're seeing out there. When the mistakes that small businesses are making, we're 4 years out of the end of the recession, supposedly, and yet small business hasn't really recovered. Everybody needs help. What are you telling people?
Yeah, I think the biggest mistake is that people aren't making decisions fast enough. I was reminded of this when I watched our politicians from both sides, how they do things, you know, putting things off to the last moment, thinking that they're going to negotiate to the final. I've made this mistake in my own career where I try to put it off, I try to think it through, I try to calculate. Typically, that is a mistake in this economy because market share is going not to the strongest player or the biggest player today. Market share is going to the people that can move the fastest. And when the small business owner tries to conserve capital, they tend to not make decisions. Right now is the time to make decisions. Good or bad, make a decision. Move forward with some speed and some momentum so you can actually go gain market share.
You know, I think that's probably right on the money. And I've seen it with companies that I know are, you know, I have a content marketing business and I work with some very big companies. But I see other companies try to say they're in content marketing and they always seem like so full of puffery, right? It's like it's not real, it's sort of real, but they move fast and they have a great website. And so whether or not they've ever done the business before, I think they're capturing clients or future clients that I could be working with simply because they're moving faster than I'm moving.
Yeah, I think what happens is they are willing, like I'm willing today to make mistakes. I just want to make them as quickly as possible.
And get through it and then make a different mistake.
And then I go make a different decision. Sooner or later, I'm going to have the right hand. You know, if I'm dealt bad cards, I just want to fold, get out. Okay, redeal the deck again. In business, I get to keep asking for a new hand. It's not how many times I lose. Can I just win that big hand? Can I win that hand when it matters, when I finally made all the adjustments I need? You know, one of the things that concerns me about small business is the name small business.
Why is that?
Because two-thirds of all small business owners have no employees. That means the commitment to staying small has been taken completely out of context.
Hmm.
You know, and basically that individual, that entrepreneur is like, I don't want to hire anybody. I don't want to bring new people on. I don't want to bring help on because you think you're saving money. People don't cost money. You know, decisions don't cost money. Not making decisions, not adding people, not growing, and not moving is what actually costs a small business owner market share and therefore money.
One of the things that I just read is that small businesses who have more than two employees or more than one employees up to like 50 employees, there's 4 million businesses, and they actually account for about, I don't know, a third of all the business that goes on. And it's a really significant part. And so is it getting over that initial hump where you hire your first person and suddenly you're at two and suddenly you're at three or four that people start to get nervous and they pull back? Or do you think that it's that first hire, that once you make that decision and you set your business on a course, that's then it's smoother sailing up to maybe wherever you get really huge, like at 50 or 100 people?
Yeah, I think a lot of people just get into business for the wrong reason. They're like, oh, I don't want to work for somebody else, so I'm going to work for myself. If you're going to work for yourself and not make a lot of money, you shouldn't work for yourself, because working for yourself it's the most work you're going to ever do. You can never get away from it. It's with you every second of every day. And I know this, having two people work below you is almost no more work than having 22 people work below you.
Yeah.
Once you get to a kind of critical mass, you get to actually start getting people around you that can start carrying the ball sometime. And so I think right now, I mean, people should be growing their businesses right now. These windows don't stay open. The economy is improving. It's improving slowly for a lot of people because I think a lot of people are just apprehensive and being too careful. Like our president has been a little too careful, or Congress or the Senate. I mean, pick them. They're all politicians are careful because they're in it for the vote.
Right.
And when you're in business, you can't be in it for a popularity contest. You have to be in it for revenue and net profits.
How do you advise companies to find new opportunities in new markets? How do you advise them to kind of look around and look outside what would normally be their box to try and figure out a new way to make money?
To be on the hunt all the time, as you know, you mentioned in the intro for me about my real estate. Real estate is not my primary business. I got into this. I've been in business for myself almost 30 years, and I started my real estate business about 12 years ago because I just love real estate. It makes sense to me, income properties, apartment buildings.
Mm-hmm.
And so when I made that move, I didn't drop my main business, which at the time was consulting for auto dealers and then other sales organizations. But on the weekends, I would just start shopping real estate. Every weekend, I would go look at real estate. And after I got enough courage and had a little bit of money that I was willing to finally say, okay, I'm going to do this. That was 3 years, by the way, 3 years of shopping. Then I'm like, okay, I'm going to pull the trigger on this. And I started a new business. And I think people could just start, you know, be alert, be looking, you know, make the decision that you're going to grow your business or businesses. If you're not making that decision, you're not going to see opportunity.
But, you know, you just made a great point, Grant, which is that it took you 3 years of research, which a lot of people would say, oh, well, he moved slow. He told me to move fast and he moved slow. But you were actively researching that business. And then once you decided to buy, it sounds like you really jumped in with both feet.
Well, it might have taken 3 years, but I bought 500 units in the first year. So,
the first year after you started buying.
Yeah, exactly.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know if that's slow or not, but also I didn't quit my other businesses. I continue to grow my other businesses and take advantage of those opportunities. You know, I see a lot of people will start a second business or they'll get another income, and they drop the first one that they had. You don't want to drop the first one to pick up a second one. You end up with one again.
Right.
The point is to keep paying attention to your main thing. Stay on that bicycle and add something you can drag behind that bicycle. So now you got two people in the cart, you know, if you will. It might be a bad analogy, but you know, once I learned real estate, then I'm like, okay, I'm going to go into another state. Once I was in California at the time. I'm like, okay, I'm going to go look at Arizona. So I made my move. When I made my move, I made it with a tremendous amount of speed.
Mm-hmm.
So once you're confident, once you're like, I'm pulling the trigger, then move as fast as you can into a market and do everything you can to get through that window while it's open, because it won't stay open forever.
So when you talk to companies and you talk to business owners and you feel like they're hesitating or there's something, they're so worried about making a mistake, do you ask them what's the worst thing that will happen if you do this and it's a complete flop and failure? What is the,
you know,
the worst thing that could happen?
What I do, at least, is I just say, look, are you going to do this or not? Yes or no? Oh, well, Grant, I need overnight to think about it. No, what you need to do is you need to make a decision right now. If it's no, make a decision right now. No. If it's a yes, make a decision. Thinking about it, sleeping on it, these are old myths and beliefs that somehow makes you safe. No, it doesn't. It just makes you worry more. So if you're going to buy the piece of equipment, buy it now. Quit playing around, quit wasting time, and pull the trigger. If you're not going to buy the piece of equipment, then make a decision not to buy it and look at it again next quarter, not tomorrow.
So when people are making fast decisions, I guess it doesn't even really matter to you whether it's the right decision or the wrong decision. If it's the wrong decision, you'll then have to make another decision to make it a right decision. Is that right?
Yeah, exactly, exactly. And here's the deal. If buying one piece of equipment is going to ruin your business was going down anyway. See, the small business owners putting too much significance on single decisions. No single decision is going to put you out of business. It's not the big ones that are killing you. It's the little ones you don't make.
How important are relationships? Relationships with the different companies? Because I find that mistakes that I'm seeing out there are that people mismanage the relationship, or they spend all the time in the relationship and none of the time in making sure the work is fabulous. I feel like you have to have both.
Well, yes. I mean, in an ideal world, I'd want to have both. But, you know, look, at the end of the day, you're going to have a core group of people that are going to be with you, both customers and employees. They're not all staying with you. I don't care how well you treat them. You can give them candy, let them play tennis during the day.
I know, they go. They grow up and they move on, right?
Sooner or later, they're moving on. Their life changes, something happens. No matter how good that relationship is, you know, you're not keeping everybody. Not having turnover, when a guy tells me he has no turnover, it really concerns me.
Right, you need fresh blood.
Yeah, and new eyeballs, you know, and people that are urgent and really want to grow something.
What about companies? What about getting that relationship with companies together so that they... You do want companies. You can have long relationships with companies as well, who as clients, no?
Yeah, but I think you always need to be hunting for new clients and new opportunities like you brought up earlier, because I can't, you know, customers are not loyal the way our parents were. You know, my dad bought a Cadillac, and that's all he ever bought. So, but today, to think that anybody's going to be an AT&T owner forever, or they're going to own one Apple product and nothing else, that world is over. And people are not loyal the way they used to. Do I want loyal customers? Certainly. But I need new, fresh customers as much as I need new, fresh blood when it comes to my employees.
We're going to take a short break. When we come back, Grant, will you give us like three strategies for selling? If you're a small business owner and you've got to sell your services, three strategies for doing that when we come back?
Sure.
All right. Grant Cardone, he is the owner of three separate businesses, television, radio. You can follow him online at Grant Cardone. I'm Elise Glink, Rebuilding America, one house at a time, starting with yours on News Talk WSB.
Expert money advice you can depend on anytime at ClarkHoward.com at midday every Sunday with Elise Glink on 95.5 FM and AM 750 News Talk WSB.
Hey, welcome back, everybody, to the Elise Glink Show. Rebuilding America, one house at a time, starting with yours on News Talk WSB. Grant Cardone, TV best-selling author, radio talk show host, he's with us right now. Hey, Grant. Three strategies that if you are selling for your small business and you're trying to build it up, what are some strategies that you can use to really boost your bottom line?
The number one thing is learn from Miley Cyrus, okay?
Miley? I had no idea you were going to say that.
Miley is my... I love Miley Cyrus, okay? I love what she did when she came out and did that first piece. I was like, oh, I know what she's doing. She's getting attention.
Right.
She got massive amounts of attention, and that's what everybody needs to do. When you think about selling your products, you have to get attention and break through the noise so that the second time when you show up on the scene, in the neighborhood, on TV, on the radio, people are like, oh, wow, I heard about that.
Mm-hmm.
So the first thing is to get massive amounts of attention, even if it's critical attention. Number two, keep getting attention. And number three, sell hard. Sell hard. Believe in your product, believe in your price, believe in your company, and sell it. Make people buy your product and service.
So what do you do when you're... Give an example for your, let's say, automotive consulting business. How do you sell hard? Or are you at a place where people, you've got all this attention, people come to you?
Well, when I talk about selling hard, I'm talking about my price is going to be higher than everybody else in the market. That forces me to hard sell my product and my service and explain to people why it's better, why it's superior, why it will get people more. When people drop their price, they don't have to sell hard. They sell price.
So you don't want to sell price. You want to sell service, or you want to sell why your product is better, or the whole package is going to be better and more effective, and why it's going to make your customer richer, smarter, better looking, thinner, or able to date Miley Cyrus.
Yeah, exactly. Look, when the recession hit, everybody started lowering their prices. And it was a terrible calculation, because if you're going to sell less product, you don't want to do it at a lower price.
Yeah.
So every time you lower your price, all you're doing is saying, I got to sell another customer. I don't want to do that. I want to get the good customers that pay me extra, that believe in me and my company, that will stay with me because of the price, and so I can sell fewer of them, or I can make a decision, let me go add some as well, but at a higher price where there's margin, where I can actually make money, which is the only reason to be in business.
It sure is. Grant Cardone, thanks so much for being with us today. I appreciate it.
Buddy, you got it.
All right. Grant is the author of 5 New York Times best-selling books. You can find them on Amazon. They're all over the place. And you can follow Grant on Twitter, at Grant Cardone. I'm Elyse Glink. Thanks so much for joining me today. I'll be back next Sunday with another edition of the Elyse Glink Show, Rebuilding America, One House at a Time, starting with yours on News Talk WSB.